with business in 2016, where we sat down to look at the R&D tax incentive program and what can be done to improve that. On the back of that, a task team was established that included business, some academics and some universities and other government departments. It finalized the report, came up with a number of recommendations, and Godfrey will then present an update on how we have managed some of those recommendations. There are recommendations that have future policy implications, but as part of our work on the R&D tax incentives, we do have plans to do a more detailed impact assessment next year, taking into account that this tax incentive program would be more than a decade old. And out of that will emerge some very, very important strategic issues that the portfolio committees would need to deal with. So we're hoping that this is a start of a process also around looking at how to maximize the impact on the R&D tax incentive. But we know that the committee is concerned about the backlog, so we will give the current statistics on where we are with that information. So without any further ado, let me hand over to Godfrey. I assume, Chair, because there's two items on this program, that we'll take about a 30-minute presentation and thereafter have questions and answers. Thanks.
Mr. Mashamba, over to you.
Good morning once more, Honorable Chair and members and colleagues. This is the briefing on the Research and Development Tax Incentive Program. The outline of the presentation, as explained by Mr. Patel, we'll give a background on the tax incentive and provide a progress update and also brief the committee about the progress we've made in implementing the recommendations of the task team that the minister established. There was a letter that was sent to the Minister of Science and Technology by the Speaker of the National Assembly requesting the Department of Science and Technology to report to the Portfolio Committee on the measures implemented to improve the efficacy of the R&D tax incentive. A number of correspondence were held with the committee around organizing this presentation. It was supposed to happen in October, but then a date of today was finally scheduled. As background, the South African government provides the research and development tax incentive with an aim to promote private sector R&D investment in the country. The R&D, we believe, is required in order to advance innovation, especially through the development of new products and processes, as well as improving existing ones. Private sector firms contribute a lot to that because they invest in R&D themselves. They also work with other organizations such as science councils, and they have links to international partners to do R&D in the country. So this incentive encourages them to do more R&D, and it's part of a package of policy instruments to promote innovation, enhance competitiveness as a measure for supporting economic growth. So the DST administers this program, working in partnership with the National Treasury and the South African Revenue Service. Companies can qualify for a 150% tax deduction on the expenditure, R&D expenditure, in terms of the Section 11D of the Income Tax Act, and the incentive is available to firms of any size and in any industry. The 150% works in this way, that at a tax rate of 28%, a company can deduct 14 cents of every rand they spend on R&D. But this works differently because of the graduated tax environment in South Africa, wherein small businesses have a preferential treatment on the graduated tax. So So the lower the tax rate, company tax, CIT tax rate for a company, the lower the level of the incentive because it's against the tax rate as such. This slide presents the process of application. A company submits an application to the Department of Science and Technology, wherein within 48 hours they receive an acknowledgement of that application. We pre-screen the applications at the department and then process the applications, assessed and presented to a committee which is established by Section 11D, under Section 11D, comprising National Treasury, SARS, and the DST, which adjudicates on these applications. That committee makes recommendations to the Minister of Science and Technology, who then makes a decision to approve or not approve based on the recommendation of the committee. A letter is then provided to the applicant as proof that they can use when they claim their tax deduction from SARS. All approved applications, companies with all with approved applications are required to report to the department on their progress on an annual basis at times that coincides with their financial year end reporting. This is very important for purposes of us to understand the impact and how the firms are using this incentive. In terms of the uptake by companies, 1061 companies have participated in the incentive by the date from 1 November 2006 to 31 October 2017. I must explain at this stage that the incentive, the 150% tax incentive, started in 2006 November, but then in 2012, a system of applying has of accessing the incentive was amended, wherein before companies used to submit their tax claims to SARS retrospectively, that is after undertaking their R&D and knowing what exactly their expenditure was and claimed as part of their tax return. But from October 2012, a new procedure was introduced where they have to apply, as I explained in the previous slide, where they have to apply and get an approval from the minister before they can submit their tax return. So the slide separates those two aspects. Under the previous system, 1,575 submissions were received at the DST. Then under the system that started in October 2012, 1,259 applications were received, of which 33 were withdrawn by the companies themselves. Then 1,137 were adjudicated by the committee. The committee still has to adjudicate on the 89, and of those that were adjudicated, 660 applications were approved, which accounts for 402 companies that were granted approval. Then the 477 were not approved, representing 356 companies. Here I must also explain that a company can submit more than one application. Some companies apply this year for multi-year projects. Because companies are different, they have different arrangements in undertaking R&D, so there will be those differences. So we sort of accounted for all those things in this slide.
In addition, a company can apply for more than one project, and so the numbers below 402 and 356 may not always add up to the number of companies applying, because companies may get approval, say, for two of their projects and may not get approval for two of their projects or three of their projects, etc.
Thanks. This is now the slide that presents the status update up to 31 October 2017. We added a slide here, Chair, Honorable Chair, that gives a much more operational detail of what happens on a weekly basis. I said 17 November, that's last Friday, because things change every week. In order for us to explain the issue of the backlog, that we have made a lot of progress in actually addressing the backlog that we had a few years back, with 93% of all the 1,239 applications, valid applications that we've received, have been adjudicated, and 81% of them have received decisions on their applications. So we are remaining with 7%, about 81 in number, of the applications that still require adjudication. And of that number, 28 were received in 2016, 53 received in 2017. So this means that all the applications that were received before January 2016 have been adjudicated. Of that number, we are only remaining with 12 that still need to receive their decisions. These are delays that are between the department and the companies themselves in providing the required information for the decisions to be made. We have started being strict on these things. That's why we are not having a build-up of latency with the firms. We are becoming strict in terms of how many days we allow a company to provide information going forward. Hence, in 2016-2017, we don't have a challenge of companies delaying, in providing information, because the quality of the application itself has an impact on the speed with which decisions can be made. So our plan at an operational level is that all the applications that were received before January 2017 would have received decisions by the end of December. And we think that is an important milestone towards us working towards a 90-day turnaround time that is committed in the DST strategic plan. Now, coming to the progress in implementing the recommendations of the task team that the minister established in November 2015 after meeting with the industry, I'll give a little bit of background that the task team comprised the persons from a range of sectors, the R&D performing companies in different sectors, industry associations, consulting firms, relevant government departments, that is DST, National Treasurer and SARS, and also academia and policy research community. The task team reviewed the issues that were identified in the meeting with the industry, the concerns that were there at the time, which include challenges with the pre-approval process that were introduced in 2012, largely because that system was creating an environment of backlogs and long turnaround times in providing decisions, creating uncertainties on the part of companies. There was concern about information required when a firm wants to access an incentive. There were also concerns regarding what does the firm need to do in order to be eligible, accessibility by small, medium enterprises and startup firms, and also the lack of an appeals process, what we refer to as an appeals process, and questions about how competitive was South Africa's incentive in the international context, and in terms of the rate and qualifying to whether the criteria for qualifying for the incentive was consistent with what is seen in other countries. So the task team started its work in November 2015 and ended in April 2016 when it adopted a final report which has been circulated to the committee. The report was then presented to the Minister of Science and Technology and the Minister of Finance and subsequently published on the DST website on the 27th of June 2016. So in summary, the task team's findings and recommendations covered a range of issues dealing with both the the measures to simplify the administrative processes as well as policy-related matters. Although these two issues are interrelated, some of them, administrative issues, have implications for policy and vice versa. So in the way that DST dealt with these recommendations is that we dealt with them as a set of interrelated set of issues. We adopted an approach that identified four clusters of activities, which are actions to simplify processes for accessing the incentive, amendments to enable companies to catch up on their claims at the Southern Revenue Service, the review of the pre-approval procedure, whether we should change, we should amend it or change it, actions to relating to policy-related matters that have arisen. So we thought that this is the best approach to actually address all the issues that were raised. DST worked with the National Treasury and SARS in this whole process, and also consulted the R&D Tax Incentive Adjudication Committee, because that committee has powers in law to advise the two ministers about a possible amendments going forward to make the incentive work, whereas the National Treasury has a responsibility for tax policy. Everything we do has to be tested for its consistency in that space, but also administratively, from the tax administration point of view, it has to make sense. So that's why the consultations, regular consultations on each and every issue that we raised. In summary, the DST accepted all the 17 recommendations that were made by the task team and committed to develop responses for each of one of them. And by the time of preparing this presentation, 14 of those recommendations were implemented, 6 of them implemented with modifications. That is, not as the task team has recommended, but we found ways to address them, alternative ways to address them, without actually following what the task team has actually recommended, but we have addressed them. So the changes that were introduced in terms of the impact have addressed the major challenges that were identified then when the task team was established. I think the next slide gives a sort of a highlight of some of the things, big things that were happening, that the quality of applications have improved. That's because improved guidance that the DST was providing to firms. We have introduced new guidelines. We've put information on the website. We've interacted more with companies. But also the simplification of the documentation helped a lot to actually improve the quality of the applications. And this has materially improved the speed of processing applications. So that graph shows that of the 2012 up to 2015 applications, that category of applications, we took an average of 14 months to actually provide a decision, which then in the 2016 applications reduced to an average of 7 months, and then in the 2017 applications it's reduced to 4 months. And we're working towards a 90-day turnaround time in the next quarter possibly. This trend, and there's a trend also that we're seeing of companies that are applying for the first time for an incentive. And we also see a likelihood that with what we're picking up in the application 2017, that we could exceed the average number of first-time applicants of 83 going forward, because now new firms are able to access the incentive, not only the regular players. And the approval rate of applications received from small, medium enterprises has actually improved from 35% in the 2014-15 applications to 41% in the 2016-17 applications. And we hope that this trend continues. So the rest of the slides presents the detail of what I've summarized now in terms of the implementation of the recommendations of the committee. So under the first cluster of activities for simplifying the ways to access the incentive, we work with the in mind with the target that the department has committed of 90 days or less of providing decisions on applications. Here, we have introduced new guidelines and which have to clarify a range of issues that were identified to lack clarity. The DST officials have made themselves readily available to meet with the business sector, and we've had various interaction with the private sector on all the businesses on the R&D tax incentive. There is an online system of submitting applications that was implemented. Besides eliminating the paper-based forms, this system also improves information management internally. The issue of recapturing information and manual processes will now change going forward. We are busy in the change management process with the companies to get them to fully utilize that system. This year, the focus is on optimizing how it's working, and within by firms when they apply, but also within the department in terms of training staff and making them accustomed to a new system of working. There's a new cohort of external experts that we are using, we've appointed, that cement the capacity of the DST in evaluating applications because we don't have enough staff internally. Then the second part, amendment to enable companies to catch up on their claims that were delayed due to a backlog, that became effective in January 2017 in the tax law. And the National Treasury is monitoring the usage of that new provision. I think the clear indication will become available at the end of the tax year in the 2018 tax statistics if that had an impact. But feedback that has been obtained from interaction with the industry so far points to poor usage of these new provisions, because the implication that if you go back, you have to reopen your tax returns, and it attracts audits, and there are costs that companies incur in doing that. So, but from the government point of view, we will see a clear indication at the end of the tax year. In the review of the pre-approval process procedure, whether to change from this current system, we have taken a view as a department after many, many consultations and also interactions with counterparts in other countries. I think the group of experts within the Organization for Economic Development Cooperation, OECD, of countries that are involved with this type of practice of implementing tax incentives has also provided very useful insights. Whereas there was a euphoria to try and change from that system and go to the other one, we said, let's be careful and see how this system would work under conditions of no backlog, because it was causing serious problems, Honorable Chair, under the conditions of backlog. But now, without a backlog going forward, we think that it has an advantage of improving certainty, which is one of the tenets of effectiveness of these type of incentives, that companies need to be certain about their eligibility and improve their planning on the R&D project or spending. Next one is the actions on policy-related matters that have arisen. Under this cluster, there are three categories of issues of a policy nature that we dealt with. Some of them straddle between interpretation of the law as it is written now, and others are to do with whether we should change a current policy approach, while others require a shift in the current policy approach. The first group of issues is issues for clarifications, which we have dealt with when we issued the new guidelines, and also in the process that we are engaged with SARS in the compilation of the new interpretation note for Section 11D. They issue an interpretation note which tells companies or guides companies what to do in order for them to access the incentive from the part of SARS and tax administration and in their part of the role, whereas the DST used the guidelines to explain the eligibility requirements. So issues included eligibility of software development. We have done work to improve guidance in that respect. Although this area still requires further work on software development and ICT-related activities for further engagement with companies. The second one is the R&D collaborations. What is the eligibility requirements in relation to where a company collaborates with other parties or get external funding or fund others? Small and medium enterprises and startup enterprises. So we only dealt with these things in as far as the current text in the law permits. So that's an issue that we have dealt with currently. Then going forward, there are issues relating to requiring technical corrections in law, which relates to issues that are highlighted on number one, because they are interrelated, these issues. On this item, the DST has discussed a proposal with the National Treasury recommending specific technical corrections to address the ambiguity in existing provisions on two issues. Firstly, is the removal of Proviso B under Section 11D. Excuse me for the language there. How it's referred to in law, which deals with the development of internal business processes. This is the challenge from the DST point of view we have addressed with the Treasurer. And secondly, the removal of the term called innovative, which appears in Section 11D1 of the Act. We think that the approach that we have taken will help assist, if these corrections, technical corrections are made, will assist interpretation and application of the CARE Act to promote certainty amongst firms, because there's multiple interpretations of these things from the side of the firms and also by various actors in the space. So the undertaking we have made with the Treasury was that, or the proposal that we presented to the Treasury was that they should consider including these proposed amendments in the next round of the tax laws amendment process, which is next year. And then the third issue concerns matters requiring substantive policy shifts, and then two recommendations identified under this category, which is firstly, to increase the 150% tax deductions. The committee has debated on this issue in our presentation in June quite extensively. Number B is to introduce a refundable tax credit to support small medium, so that as an alternative way to support small enterprises. So DST's response is as follows, that the two recommendations are not feasible over the medium term due to fiscal constraints. The two will also require substantial changes in the tax policy approach, and if they are to be considered, a business case need to be developed. And our approach is that we will want to first undertake an impact evaluation, which will inform us about the desirability of these, and also whether they will actually change if the problems that were identified are not being addressed under existing structures. So one thing that we consider is that other than the R&D tax incentive, there are a number of other incentives or policy measures that the government is championing to actually deal with R&D and innovation in the country. And also, not only R&D, but investment in general, because R&D is a subset of the broad area of investment by firms. So there is a focused work across government also. A committee will appreciate to support or improve the support for small, medium enterprises, the competency of which is not primarily with the Department of Science and Technology, but lies in other departments like Small Business Development and the DTI, and others. The DST contributes to that in various ways. In conclusion, Honorable Chair, it is recommended that the Portfolio Committee on Science and Technology notes the status update presented and the progress made in implementing the recommendations of the Joint Government Industry Task Team. The DST and the National Treasury continue to monitor the feedback and experiences in order to identify possible improvements and areas that require technical clarifications in law to improve, to remove ambiguity. Also, to also look at the policy changes and adjustments, possible policy changes and adjustments or legislative amendments. The National Treasury and the DST communicate on these issues when there are new developments. While I'm saying this, we are planning in the department to host a similar meeting that we had in 2015, November, which we are proposing that the minister should address the business sector again on these matters. For us to, because transparency is important in this, for us to engage the business sector in terms of their experiences of what has been implemented so far, if that has had a material impact in terms of how they see the program, and also how to improve impact and returns for the country on this. So the last point is that the Portfolio Committee will be presented with the 2016-17 report, which the Minister is required to submit to Parliament, to present to Parliament annually on the performance of the tax incentive. But this report is still going through the clusters of government and also approval processes. It will be presented here once it becomes available. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mashamba. Mr. Patel, want to say something?
No, nothing. We're ready to take any questions or comments.
Okay. Thank you once again for the presentation and clarification on some issues. Let me then open to honorable members to pose questions. Honorable Tuck, Honorable Koronwolf, Honorable King, Honorable Tembegwane. In that order. Honorable Tuck.
Chairperson, on page 3, the second slide, my question is, I would like to see a list of companies that has qualified. And the second question is, also I don't see a criteria that has been used for these companies to qualify. And my next question is on page 6, the second slide, simplifying processes for assessing the incentive. There I would like to know, did you budget for the external experts that were appointed to supplement DST capacity in evaluating applications? Thank you, Chairperson. That's my questions.
Thank you, Honorable Tuck. Honorable Koronov.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Can I, you know, we all know that we are lacking behind in terms of our science and technology investment in terms of the fiscus, and obviously, therefore, we need private sector and the business, you know, to contribute. So this tax incentive is important, that it works, that it's smooth, and that people are really eager to join it. So my first question is there an R&D definition in the Income Tax Act? It appears that there is one because you are proposing some changes, but is there an R&D definition in the Income Tax Act? Then secondly, when the DST assess and they propose to SARS, is there a fight between DST and SARS, or do they then accept the DST recommendation? or is there always a coming back, you know, with regard to that and making it more difficult with regard to that?
We've got enough, Honorable King.
I only have two questions, but the others was already covered. For unsuccessful applicants, what is the time frame for them to appeal before they can be told it's successful or unsuccessful again? And then just a comment that I wanted to make in relation to increasing the 150 tax percent deduction rate and to introduce a refundable tax credit to support SMEs. You said it will not be feasible in the medium term, but if you have to consider the budget constraints that we are under and that over the past few years we see the budget have declined considerably for the Department of Science and Technology, do you think there will ever be a feasibility for it to be effective or to come into play?
Thank you, Honorable King. Dr. Tembegwaya.
Thank you very much. I just would like to ask on page 4, slide number 7. Yes, slides about the status update in processing applications. More specifically, on the October 2012, December 2015. Information, but specifically on the last one, adjudicated, and in brackets, require sign-off by the minister. That 12, those 12, I think it's 12 companies, and also including the January 2016, December 2016, the 34, also that require sign-off by the minister to say, if we compare the information, you talked about the turnaround times. How can this 12 and 34 be accommodated into this 90-day turnaround time as per DST strategic plan? Because maybe there are some, for an example, information requirements that are problematic to them. There's always terms that are used in application forms that can be so difficult for other people to merely understand what is meant or what is it that is needed for them to be successful in this. And then my question is, how are you going to accommodate them, taking into consideration that on page, there's somewhere where you talked about the page 6, slide number 12, where mention is made of DST officials are readily available to meet with businesses and then to raise awareness and explain how the incentives work, not only on how the incentive works. Let the awareness maybe inclusive here of those sections in the application that can be problematic to other companies that causes the backlog of 12 in 2015, inclusive of 34 in 2016. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Tembegwaya. Welcome, Dr. Lotrit. I think I just want to say that the 150% tax deduction on R&D, I think it is in line because as a committee we continuously trying to advocate to have a separate budget for R&D. So, and we believe that if that's done, even the incentive scheme will be effective. More. So I'm saying it's also in line with the thinking of the committee. But on slide 6, that of all the companies that submitted application under the pre-approval system, 53% have been granted approval. So where is the 47% sitting?
then the turnaround time on especially on the signature of the minister has been a concern for the committee, and it's a question that comes out now and then on this issue, and also see that there's still a number of those application that require the minister's signature that are still outstanding and sitting there. So despite the fact that there's those external experts that have been appointed, so I think the question is, what is the actual delay from the minister? Because it's been the past years there's been this backlog from awaiting her signature. There is improvement, but it's still behind. And I just want to, if you could explain to us, what is the target rate that is expected on the approval of application, and this thing, you're hoping as to by when will you have cleared the backlog and be just in line with your strategic plan? Yeah, I think the others, honourable members, have covered. Yeah, if your responses to that, Mr. Patel.
Thanks, honourable chair. With your permission, I'll take one matter, then give Godfrey to go through the list and see what he can address, and then I'll do a sweep after he's addressed as well. So I'll come twice. But I thought I'll come first because it's again unfortunate that in putting things in the presentation, the slides may not cover what is the delay. So putting it on record, the delay is not with the minister. The delay is with the officials. The remaining applications are largely ones where there's no approval. And because there's no approval, we need to send it to our colleague here, Normandy, January, to look at from a legal perspective from SARS, because that letter can be contested. We have had few contestations where people can come in. So in formulating that letter, it's the officials that needs to make sure that it crosses everything, and we've given enough time to go back, and we have a solid case for kind of refusing. And until the submission reaches the minister, she can't sign off. So we do have turnaround times because those applications go through me, to the DG, to the minister. That's the line. We all have signed confidentiality agreements because it's a question about the list of companies, and we turn around those in a day as soon as we get it from the team. So the delay is on the side of the team, not from the side of the minister, so I need to clarify that. And the reason why there's a delay in 15-16, until the end of 16, is that those are the most difficult cases. They were really tough cases, and it goes to the question that Honorable Kuranov raised, is there a fight between SARS and DST? Not necessarily, because there's a lot of interpretation. So you need to sit down, and where there's a lot of contestation is in borderline cases, where something is sitting there. It could be R&D, it couldn't be R&D, and that's where we then have to get the external experts to do it, etc. As each department is mandated to perform its responsibilities. SARS obviously would adopt a more conservative attitude. Every approval they give means that there's less income to the fiscus. So as far as possible, they would want to make sure that we're not granting people who shouldn't be granted. The DST is more flexible on that, and there's been a lot of learning between the officials on the adjudication committee where we have a better understanding now. So we have precedent. If something comes through, the committee has a way to say, in fact, this qualifies or it doesn't qualify. It's been mainly around areas like we had problems with clinical trials before, and then we corrected the law, and now it's clear what's there. The biggest one that still poses a challenge is services, IT, software development. So if a company changes its website and it changed its brand, like Vodacom has gotten red instead of blue in the past, and they change all of that and they have to do development work, should that qualify as R&D? Not really. And so it's those kinds of things that begin to get a lot more on the borderline. So what I wanted to clarify, Chair, is that the problem is not with the minister. The problem is it hasn't reached the minister yet. And as soon as it reaches the minister, we get that back in a day if the minister is not traveling, in 2 days at the most. So she has been processing those, and they're as thick as this. So they're not, they have detailed letters. Each letter is about 4 or 5 pages long, and it has to say, according to POPI, etc., these are your valid reasons, and our legal services has to sign that off, including the chair of the adjudication committee, etc. And because we wanted to ensure that there's as minimal comebacks as possible, where people have to go to court to contest, because it's not good for either companies or ourselves, we try to make sure that we provide full and valid reasons. So just to clarify that, we are confident that the 2015-2016 applications, which is the 12 plus 34, that's 46, will be signed off by the minister, because we would have gotten this batches to the minister by sign-off. The team has now has a pipeline of batches, and as soon as they're ready, then they get sent to people. In future, the target date, Honorable Chair, is to do what we call a 90-day turnaround time. But there's two important conditions that we've implemented. It's 90 days after we receive a full and complete application. Because the problem in the past is you don't receive full and complete applications, and if the deadline starts ticking in, there's not much we can do. So as soon as we know we have a full and complete application, we start counting the days down. And then the end date is the date on the letter that the minister sends to the company. We then monitor each application and then report through our quarterly progress reports on what's the average number of days that it's taking us. We're quite confident that once the backlog is clear, and we regard the backlog as anything that was before December 2015. Now we've included December 2016. So if we clear that by December, then what we'll be dealing with is only current application. We might still struggle in the first quarter of 2017-18 to get to the 90-day turnaround time, but with the systems that we have in place now, the experts, the online system, the committee is working much better. They take less time to adjudicate applications because they have a shared language, that we're quite confident that we will achieve a 90-day turnaround time on the majority of applications. To end of year, we've looked at other jurisdictions on how they define their performance indicators around this. And for example, I think it was Canada. Canada's performance indicator is that they will deal with 80% within the 90-day turnaround time, and then the rest is where, again, you'll always have particularly difficult cases. Either the project is complex or the application was complex. So we're quite confident that we'll be able to report positively next year around the 90-day turnaround time. I'll ask Godfrey then to go through all of the comments, and anything that I feel needs a bit more emphasis, I will then come back and then we can conclude.
Good, Mr. Patel, leave the difficult ones to
It's a wonderful one.
Thank you very much. I think the issue relating to delays, I mean, even the work that we have been doing this year has been largely impacted on by the historical backlog, because the available staff members spent a lot of time processing historical work. So obviously we've made progress in doing that. That's why now for next year we're talking about operating in a more efficient a platform, now that the historical work or backlog has been cleared. There were challenges relating to that, hence the process that the minister initiated of the task team to say, how can we deal with all those issues that were raised about clarity of criteria, guidance provided to firms, efficient process applying and also processing these applications. So the backlog was a result of all those issues, combinations of those issues, and the tos and fros. Complexity of the forms also impacted on this, that the clarity of the information provided by firms, where we have to go to firms and come back, and understanding also that the weaknesses in the type of information that we requested. So a lot of time has been spent with firms to clarify exactly what is required. So that's one thing that actually took a lot of staff time on our side. Now, coming to the issue of the definition, there is a definition under Section 11D, which explains the criteria. I'll just break it down in English, not in the legal language. That what it requires is the that a firm would qualify or a project would qualify if it involves discovery of non-obvious scientific and technological knowledge. Obviously, the definition of R&D is adopted from the international guidelines called the Frascati Manual, which historically has been prepared. I mean, originally, this document, Frascati Manual, was produced in order to guide statistical collections on R&D. It was not done for it to guide the definition of how countries implement R&D tax incentives, but it provides a useful basis from which countries draw and craft the criteria for R&D, which South Africa has done. But when it comes to the tax law, the language has to be different from what is in the cross-cutting guidelines, because you can't adopt it the way it is. Yes, it's implemented in the space of tax administration. The second part is that a firm must be creating or developing an invention, a functional design, a computer program, or what is called a multi-source pharmaceutical product, or these are new pharmaceutical products, or the knowledge essential to the usage of all these things. The third component is that it must be making also a significant improvement of any of these things, like invention, functional design, computer program, of new pharmaceutical products. The fourth part is that a project can qualify if it involves conducting a clinical trial of a phase 1, 2, or 3. Fourth phase of clinical trials is not eligible because that is now marketing. So these are the criteria that are used that are also included in the Section 11D. The list of approved firms were restricted by law to give out a list of firms. The way we are required to report about this is that it must be done in an anonymous fashion. That's why in the annual report that we produce, we talk about sizes of firms or categories in terms of sectors or type of R&D activities undertaken, instead of giving out names of firms. We're not allowed to do that by law. We think that the way we present it in the annual report, which the committee will be presented with shortly, gives very useful insight in terms of what type of firms are actually benefiting from this incentive. The fourth point, yes, we have budgeted for the external experts. We pay them under the departmental budget line on professional services. The ones that we have now, we have contracted them for a period of 2 years, so we allocate applications to them in terms of their areas of expertise, and they are given turnaround times to respond to the point by the chair that if we have external experts, why then are there delays? We give them a due dates by which they should submit or present their evaluations, And I don't think we have big challenges at the present moment, as opposed to historically. We used to have challenges in the past. I mean, the whole team internally at the DST, including also the firms that applied, I think we have learned and we are better at what we are doing now than we were before. Firms have a better understanding of the requirements. We also have a better understanding of these requirements and also the objective, what we're trying to achieve with this program. The issue that we're lagging behind internationally, yes, in the broader scheme of things, the science and technology system in South Africa compared to where we want to be is not at that scale, but there are programs to actually get there. The issue of 150% and the refundable tax credit is that with the 150 tax credit, there was a study that there is a survey that some of these global companies do on these incentives, the OECD and also the Deloitte one that I've read recently, which confirmed, including what we have included in that report, the testing report a few years back, it confirms that South Africa is one of those countries that it's among the countries that offer what is called super deductions. Super deductions is that they offer higher than 100% tax rate returns on or the tax rate deductions on the R&D tax incentive. It's amongst those countries, leading countries in that space. But there are countries that are quite aggressive, which go and offer tax holidays for what they call pioneer firms, like Singapore and them. They go up to 300% tax deductions. But our discussions that we've had at DST with the Treasury is that we are not ready to move into that space. We're still competitive internationally because also the amount that a company benefits, the 14 cents that the company end up benefiting from the incentive, is also a function of the corporate income tax. Some of these countries that offer 200%, and you'll find that when you work out how much the firm gets at the end, it compares well with what South Africa. I just don't have the slide. I've worked on a slide like that, where we show this thing that we're still pretty competitive. But then again, the offering of the tax incentive is not the only measure that should be put in place. There must be a whole improvement of the investment environment and also the R&D environment to encourage firms to go into this space. The refundable tax credit has implications in that for the budget, on budget, just to be on budget, because companies that are not able to claim immediately have to be given the funds in cash. So that's a problem to propose with the Treasury at the moment. Plus, this issue has been entertained before when this particular incentive was being proposed around 2005, 4, 5, somewhere there. And a decision that was taken was that it was going to be a little bit inconsistent with the overall tax approach, policy approach that was then at the time, which is still what is the situation now. So it requires a whole shift in the approach to tax tax policy. That's why in the short term we said it's not something that's feasible. We can only consider it after the impact assessment has been done. Slide number 7. I know you spoke about slide number 7.
I've addressed it.
Okay.
The guidelines.
Yeah, the guidelines question. I think some of these things in terms of how applicable are the eligibility criteria to firms are things that have are case by case issues where we get to a company and then we work with them and to understand in their situation how best to present their information. We've been interacting. The past 4 weeks we've been interacting with the mining industry. We're visiting, doing some site visits to to the mining R&D facilities together with the DTI, and we're getting some sense in explaining things with them about what type of activities we have approved and then what new activities are they doing, trying to get a better understanding of this. Now that we are operating in a space of no backlog at all, we are in a position to have more of such interactions, which will also empower the team in understanding how the industry works and what are the prospective projects that are coming up. I think I must have dealt with a range of issues that I kept.
Chair, in terms of my list, I've marked off, and I think most issues have been addressed. I just want to highlight three additional ones which may help. Godfrey has been working with this for a long time, and it also took me a long time to get into the technicalities, because it's related to the two questions about the criteria and the R&D definition in a sense. The way the R&D tax incentive is structured is it has, under Section 11D, it has a number of sub-clauses. And so when a company applies, it needs to say under which sub-clause it applies. It can apply under more than one sub-clause. So Godfrey read out that if there's novelty, if it's a new design, et cetera, they can apply under many conditions. So we get applications where people tick, you know, three or four sections. What the adjudication committee has to do is they have to test the application against each criteria. So we have cases where the sign-off indicates that, and the issue is that as long as you meet one of the criteria, you qualify. You don't have to meet more than one criteria. So sometimes a company applies and says, we're going to have a new design, plus we're doing something that is novel, et cetera, et cetera. We evaluate each of the conditions, and then when we write to the company, we would indicate to them that, yes, you've qualified under this clause, but we don't agree with you under this clause. So in future, when they apply, they're aware under which clause that they have gotten this, yeah, this application. So that's quite important because these criteria developed with time. So we had a long process of review around clinical trials, as an example, where we agreed that between phase one and phase three would be covered, but we wouldn't cover phase four, because that's more in the production space. And those are the kind of borderline issues. And then when Godfrey talks about technical corrections and where we have to sit with SARS and others, it's actually on the criteria to make sure that the criteria is driving the right behavior. So I think if that explains it, and that's why some of it is also complex, because for each, if they've applied under four criteria, you need to give them adequate reasons why they didn't qualify under more than one criteria. If they get approved, we just tell them they've gotten approved, but for which criteria they got approved, we don't have to give them reasons why not around it. So that's the first issue to address. The second, I thought, just to strengthen, is this issue about the 150% refundable tax credit. Godfrey explained earlier that and it explains why, Chair, when you talked about the budget vote, this wouldn't appear in the budget vote, because what the 150% does is it shows up in your macroeconomic indicators as reduced taxation. It's not really new money. It's funny money, for want of a better word. So if the revenue collection was R1 trillion and you've given R2 billion through the tax incentive program, your treasury documentation will say we only collected 998 billion rands, not R1 trillion. So it's not necessarily money available, it's more tax deduction. And the important thing about the 150% is that you have to look at this in the context of the overall tax regime. So countries like Singapore, etc., offering 300%, their effective company tax rate is much lower. So rand for rand, we may be offering the same amount back to companies for doing R&D tax incentive. And that's the measure that we use in our international studies to decide whether it's adequate. And based on those studies, we do not think that at this stage we need to go any higher. What we need to do is to drive the right behavior. And then if we see that there's take-up and that, you know, we can get more companies into the net, with the right kind of R&D, then maybe at that point in time it's consideration. The refundable tax credit is entirely different. That has to be on budget. So then it will appear on the expenditure line item. And so even if we have to think about it, we have to ask on whose budget does this lie? Because you have to give back a refundable tax credit, and it would appear and would need to be approved by portfolio committees around it. And so that is what Godfrey meant, that we would need to take a completely different policy stance, because we're giving a grant as a refundable tax credit. It's no longer an R&D tax incentive that's managed through the tax system. So those are the kind of some of the big issues that I thought we would need to address in terms of the design of this year. And therefore, the two big policy matters are not off the table, but what we have proposed is that let's do business cases on each of them so that we have we have a process of thinking about the cost and the benefits in a fully integrated way, but not to do that now. Let's wait for the impact report to come through, because if the impact report says things are picking up, SMMEs are qualifying, the pressure to introduce one of those policy instruments may fall away.
Thank you very much, Mr. Patel and Mr. Mashamba. I think Honorable Tak had a follow-up question, and Dr. Tembewai.
My follow-up question is that one regarding the law that prevents you. I would have liked to know which law, the name of the law.
Thanks, Dr. Tembewai.
I still would like to, I'm not satisfied. On the slide 7, in brackets, where you say adjudicated, and then in brackets, require sign-off by the minister. The impression that I have is that it's the problem of the minister. This 12 and 34 was caused by the fact that the minister was required to sign off, and she did not do it. Unless if you change this wording so that we don't have to put the blame on the minister, but we have to put the blame on the officials where those letters are circulated to. Thank you.
Thanks. Again, that's the reason why I intervened first. It's unfortunate that the wording is put like that. The problem is not with the minister. The problem, well, it's not even a, I wouldn't even regard it as a problem. It's that the applications have been adjudicated. So we have made a decision, or the adjudication committee has a recommendation. And in these cases, and Godfrey can correct me if I'm wrong, they're all non-approvals, 12 and 34.
Not
the majority are non-approvals.
No.
On the 12 and 34, remember?
Okay. I wouldn't say no, but they are not necessarily. They are
combination. So part of these 12 and 34 is that they were complicated cases. And they were recently finalized. The adjudication was recently finalized. I think the last pre-2015 adjudication we did was about 2 months ago. So these are things that have been recently adjudicated, or they need to be their letters need to be finalized with full and proper reasons on why their applications have been rejected. So as I was explaining earlier, until the minister gets the letters, she's not able to sign it off. So what that should have said is that adjudicated, letters being prepared by the secretariat for minister sign off. In fact, we have advised the team to do that. So that's the issue. That's why I was going to put it on record here, that the minister gets these letters and signs off as soon as she prioritizes these letters, even though they're quite voluminous. So we've never had a problem that once the minister gets the letters, and the letters provides full and proper reasons and proper motivation for the recommendation of the adjudication committee, the minister signs those off. So it's not. So that's for the record. We will find better language around that term. Then there was a second question about the law. You can indicate which law.
Yes, I can indicate which law, but we also have the head of legal in the department who is well aware with other provisions in the legal space around these kind of things. But the ones that I'm referring to here is the section 11D. It has a particular section, 11D17, which it says. I think it's that one and the other one. Section 17, it requires us that when we report as a department, we should do this without disclosing the identity of any person. Person, it should have been also referring to companies that are applying here. There's another section, subsection in this particular. It's number 18, section 11D18, which restricts every employee of the department or any person appointed to assist, any person whose assistance has been obtained by the department or the committee to preserve and aid in preserving secrecy with regard to all matters that come to their knowledge. That also, the way we were advised, in terms of our operational model or approach, is that we cannot disclose the identities of companies and their details as such. But if we are to present information, we have to do it in a way that is anonymized. I think that the head of legal if maybe wants to come in, because there are also provisions in the Tax Administration Act that relate to disclosure and non-disclosure and things like this.
Yes, Honorable Chair, I support my colleague Godfrey. We use the Income Tax Act as well as the Tax Administration Act when it comes to disclosure of confidentiality of information of taxpayers. The reason is the SARS makes it a point that all the taxpayers, their identity is concealed in all terms so that people can pay tax voluntarily and without any fear of their names being disclosed. So that's the main objective of not disclosing the name of the company, but to classify them per category of the sort.
I think the main concern is that these companies are benefiting from the incentive of the department. And if you want to benefit, you can't be in secret. So it really is you want to come in? Yes.
Sorry, on that one. Unfortunately, now as it is, they are defined as taxpayers, which is defined in the SARS Act. So the SARS Act, when it talks of taxpayers, the SARS Act explains you can't do this to a taxpayer, you can't do this. But ours now, that one of Section 11D, like you are saying, is different. We've raised it up with SARS to say, but although it still falls under the definition of taxpayer, but they are benefiting, they are different from that one. And those are amendments which proposals were made,
okay.
And they are looking at it. But as it stands now, the law, they are still fall under the taxpayers, and you must be guided by the disclosures in terms of the SARS Act. Thank you.
It's one of the laws that they've made proposals for amendment for the disclosure of the names. Please, Honorable Chuck.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I've heard, but I still don't understand why it should be a secret, like you said. Because other things with other taxpayers, it's in the open, why not this one? But I'll accept this.
I think the explanation is that according to the tax laws, they're supposed to be, but they have made recommendation for amendment. Come here, they speak of, they've submitted amendment for laws in relation to the tax laws for disclosure of those, because even if they are taxpayers, but they are beneficiaries of the department, and we need to know. Those names need to be public. I mean, they benefit from taxpayers' monies. for those incentives. So I think we will make a follow-up. This will be one of the issues that we will be oversighting very closely on that. Mr. Mashamba.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Yeah, I think it's a useful issue to raise. Considering we have also raised the same issue, not understanding the inconsistencies between this particular provision with the 12I, Section 12I, which is administered by the DTI, which requires the department to disclose names of approved, companies and the amounts approved. In this case, it's not there, but we've asked for clarity from the, because we don't write the law from the DST we implement, to the Treasury to clarify this issue. It needs follow-up, it's true. But as it is currently, we are not permitted to do that.
According to the legal advice.
Yes, thanks. I think, as I said, that we will be following up and monitoring those amendments that we have sent, and also in our other interaction with those departments or the portfolio committees in relation to that. We will raise those issues. Honorable Kekan. Thanks. Honorable King?
Yeah.
You're fine?
Oh.
Okay.
I specifically asked about your handling of appeals. Now, I see you did add in a clause according to your recommendation, but it still doesn't answer the question, time frame. It cannot be left open, otherwise it might take a year for them to actually appeal again.
Again, I will ask a support from the head of legal on this issue, because they we are also advised on the operation side by what is allowable. There is no explicit process of appeal provided in here. Hence, the task team has raised this an issue that we need to have a process of appeal to be put in place. What we have implemented, which is what we are implementing now, is the... Can you explain the PADGA thing? I'm
not explaining properly in the right kind of legal language.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. In terms of the income tax law, there's no appeal. There's only a review. Reason being, the decision is taken by the minister. So in the South African law, there's a principle of functus officio, which means you are bound by the decision that you have taken. So you cannot review your own decision. The court must set aside that decision. So that is what the income tax law has as a provision. Currently, what we do when we process this application, which is one of the delays, because we've realized that the taxpayers or the companies, they don't have a recourse except the review, which is costly. So before we take a decision, we send a letter saying, give us reasons in terms of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, why your application should not be rejected. So in that process, we also cover the taxpayer or the company as well as the department, so that if there's an omission which we have made as a department, we are able to go back and check whether there's any error that we have made in law administratively, so that we correct it before a decision is taken, because once a decision is taken, we cannot set it aside. But one of the recommendations made by the task team is that have a discussion with SARS, because that is their legislation, to have an appeals committee, which will be outside of the DST, an independent appeals committee that would look on these non-approvals. But currently, as it stands, the income tax law does not allow the companies to appeal, but they've got a recourse of review, which is 180 days from the date of decision, or from the day they became aware of the decision that has been made. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Any other question on Weber? Okay, thank you very much to Mr. Patel and Mr. Mashamba and the other team members for the presentation and clarification of question. And as I said, that we will be also monitoring and we'll also be engaging the other portfolio committee related to the issue of the amendments. Thank you very much. And welcome to Dr. Thomas of the Heart. Welcome. Thanks. Honorable members, if you want to stay, you can stay over. If you want to, you can leave. But maybe let's have a 5 minutes break, and then members can also take tea or whatever, and then we get to the presentation on the bill. Thank you.
Yeah. What they do is they have a device that the user has an Adobe. So I send this person information on the Adobe user. What can you
do?
Okay, honorable members, can we take our seats so that we start? Welcome once again, honorable members, and officials from the department. Dr. Thomas of the High, over to you.
Thank you very much, honorable chair. Good morning, honorable chair, and good morning, honorable members. May I assume that the colleagues from the DST and Mr. Mashlangu from the NRF have already introduced themselves earlier on?
Yeah.
Thank you very much, and I think I've met all of the honorable members before, and they've met me before as well. Honorable chair, honorable members, I was given to understand that today the committee would appreciate a presentation on the NRF Act Amendment Bill as an introduction to the process that the committee will then be engaging on in considering and refining the bill, and we very much look forward to the support of the committee in achieving the intentions that we had in putting the bill before you. So that is then what I would like to outline to the committee today. Why did we bring this here, and what have we done in order to give effect to the intention? So I'd like to start off straight away with outlining, honourable members, the need for an amendment of the Act. more than just changing a few words. The following are the key considerations that led us to proposing an amendment of this Act. The first is what we've called the paucity of the NRF Act on determination of national research and funding policy by the Minister. So the current Act is not clear about what exactly is the function of the Minister and how would the Minister exert that function and authority with regard to national policy on research and research funding in particular. And it's important to spell these things out so that we can manage well the dual responsibilities of institutional autonomy and institutional accountability. The second one is that the silence on the NRF mandate on functions that relate to supporting and promoting public awareness of and engagement with science. We have on several occasions made presentations to the Portfolio Committee of the programs of the Department of Science and Technology around science engagement, science outreach, and science communication. The NRF has played a key agency role in respect of science engagement, but it was never codified in their Act. And it was important, therefore, to codify this in the Act now, so that they're doing it, in a sense, legally. The third point here is a lack of clarity in the Minister's role on the determination of national research facilities, as well as the withdrawal of such determination. So the Act was previously not completely clear on the role the Minister would play in approving the establishment of national research facilities. These are the ones we're talking about now within the National Research Foundation, like ITEMBA Labs, like the South African Astronomical Observatory. These are the national research facilities we're talking about. The Act was previously not clear about the role of the Minister in regard to the establishment or disestablishment of such national research facilities within the NRF. The fourth point, honourable members, was the provision to the Minister of powers to declare research institutions that can participate in NRF funding programs. So while it may be obvious that all the public universities should be eligible for national research funding, and all the science councils, the public science councils, should be eligible for research funding, what about private universities? Should they be eligible for national research funding? What about NGOs that are involved in research, and there's many of them? Should they be eligible for national research funding? So there's a whole spectrum of institutions and organizations beyond the obvious ones which potentially could be eligible or might be or should be eligible for research funding support from the National Research Foundation. And so it was necessary to clarify within the Act also the role of the Minister in regard to declaring research institutions as compared to national research facilities, which are the ones that sit in the NRF. The fifth point that we've made here is the exclusion of technology transfer and intellectual property management to distinguish the National Research Foundation from TIA. In 1998, when the NRF Act was originally promulgated, the Technology Innovation Agency was not in existence. It only came into existence in 2007, as I recall, and it was established by the department specifically to facilitate and promote, manage and fund technology development, technology transfer, commercialization, intellectual property management and commercialization. Those are no longer functions of the National Research Foundation. Though in the original Act, the National Research Foundation had certain responsibilities in this regard as well. So we need to clarify the Act in order to distinguish the NRF roles from the TIA roles in the contemporary circumstances. And then the last point, honourable members, was to provide further clarification on functions of the NRF, and this will become a little bit clearer. These were more technical issues. This will become a bit clearer as I take the honourable committee members through this presentation in a little more detail. And then the last point we wanted to make here also is, you may recall that the Minister in 2012 commissioned a high-level review of the National System of Innovation. As I recall, I think the chair at that time was Professor Nonta. He was the chair of that review committee, and that committee also recommended certain actions on the NRF Act. So that then is the context for the changes that we propose to the committee. Starting off now, still at a high level, the new object of the foundation. The text that I've presented on the slide here is the text that is in the bill, and all of it is new. Although perhaps some of the concepts within it are not new, the way that it is expressed here and the way that the things are linked together is somewhat new. So the object of the foundation is to contribute to national development by, and it's important to point out here that everything it does is in pursuit of national development. So it's not research for its own purpose. It's research in pursuit of national development. So supporting and promoting research and human capital development through funding and the provision of necessary infrastructure in order to facilitate the creation of knowledge, innovation, and development in all fields of science and technology, including humanities, social sciences, and indigenous knowledge. To some honorable members, the concept of science may automatically include humanities and social sciences and indigenous knowledge, but not to everybody. And it was necessary, we felt, therefore, to spell this out for those who did not see or understand the concept of science as extending to those disciplines. Developing, supporting, and maintaining national research facilities. These are things like the South African Astronomical Observatory, the South African Radio Astronomy Observatory, the SKA project, Itemba Labs. Supporting and promoting public awareness of and engagement with science. This is the specific requirement of the NRF to manage science engagement, which previously the Act was silent on. So we've introduced that now into the object of the foundation. And then lastly, promoting and development and maintenance of the national science system and supporting government priorities. This again was not explicit in the original Act, although it ought to be. And so these items have now been introduced into the new object of the foundation. On this slide, honorable members, we present to you an overview of the substantive amendments, and then I will run through them briefly, one by one, afterwards. So the first amendment was related to the power of the minister to determine relevant policies for research and funding at national level and issue policy guidelines in respect of the foundation's objectives. This required some changes to Section 3A of the Act. Inclusion of the function, the second substantive amendment was inclusion of the function of the foundation to coordinate science engagement activities in the NRF mandate, which is required some changes in Section 4. The third one was the power of the minister to determine, withdraw, and transfer a national research facility. These are the ones within the National Research Foundation. The fourth is the power of the minister to declare an institution conducting research as eligible to receive funding from the foundation. So that's to distinguish those institutions who may from those who may not receive funding from the National Research Foundation. The fifth point was the alignment of the NRF Act with other acts which are meant to protect knowledge emanating from public-funded research. Mainly, this is the IPR Act of the department. And then lastly, a clarification of NRF functions. So I'll take the Honourable Committee through these 6 points now. So turning to the first amendment, the power of the minister to guide policy. So if I may draw the members' attention to the second column here, the purpose of this amendment. The Act does not make provision for the minister to make policies and issue guidelines for research, funding, and with regard to the NRF's objectives. So we propose adding a new section into Section 3 of the Act, which should provide for these powers. And the text that we have proposed to the committee is Section 3A then, powers of minister to issue policy guidelines. One, in pursuit of the government's objectives and those of the foundation, the minister may, after consultation with the foundation and any other relevant minister, determine national policies for research and funding to be implemented by the foundation, and two, the minister may, after consultation with the foundation, issue national policy guidelines for the implementation of the policies referred to in subsection 1. I would like to draw the members' attention here to the careful use of the words or the concept of national policy guidelines. We haven't used in this act anywhere the word directives, although I have heard this word being used in several other government departments. We have not introduced such wording in this act, precisely because the purpose of this act is to enable everybody to understand better the management of these two concepts of institutional autonomy and institutional accountability. So the purpose or the benefit or impact of this amendment is an improved strategic focus and impact of research outputs and outcomes emanating from NRF-funded researchers, because the minister will now have authority to guide the NRF with respect to the focus for research activities in the country. The second important amendment that I would like to draw then the Honourable Committee's attention to is this one dealing with the science engagement function, making this an explicit responsibility of the department. And here the Principal Act does not make provision for the NRF to support and promote public awareness of and engagement of science. We therefore propose insertion of a new paragraph in subsection T2 to provide for the NRF to support public awareness of engagement of science. And the text that we have recommended to the committee is that the NRF would then coordinate relevant research institutions and targeted science advancement and outreach activities. And the reason this clause makes reference to research institutions and science outreach activities in the same breath is because it's not only the National Research Foundation through SASTA that engages in science engagement activities, but many other research institutions in the country. The Agricultural Research Council participates in this. The CSIR does. The HSRC does. And so the NRF would be responsible for coordinating these activities across a suite of different research institutions. And then paragraph B, the new one, coordinate science engagement by, one, little Roman one, supporting the involvement of targeted groups of the society in science engagement, little Roman two, designing and implementing science engagement activities and initiatives and activities, and little Roman three, managing the department-supported science engagement program. So this is the specific role of SASTA, the South African Agency for Science and Technology Advancement, in the NRF. And the benefit of this amendment then is a more efficient and coordinated science engagement function in the NRF and improved data management, which will contribute to awareness on science, profiling of South African science and science achievements, and a critical public that engages in debates. The third area then is the Declaration of National Research Facilities. And these are the ones that sit within the National Research Foundation, not outside. So here, currently, the Act does not enable the NRF to incubate units that have the potential to become national research facilities. While in theory this is obvious, the Act is silent on this specific responsibility at this stage, and the NRF proposed that it should make an explicit recognition of this. And so we have inserted into the bill this function of incubation, and it then reads as follows. The NRF would investigate and assess the need for new or additional research facilities or the withdrawal of an existing national research facility and make recommendations to the minister. And the NRF would incubate qualifying facilities prior to their declaration as a national research facility. So it makes explicit now the NRF's responsibility in this regard. And this, of course, would the impact or benefit of this would be that it allows us then to manage a growth in the research base and the research infrastructure of the country by utilizing the management experience and skill and competence of the NRF. Continuing on this point of the declaration of the national research facilities and how best to manage this, another amendment that we felt was necessary was an amendment of the definition of national facilities, which they are currently, what they are currently referred to read as national research facilities, simply for linguistic and conceptual continuity, because we're talking about the minister declaring research institutions outside the NRF that are eligible for funding, and so for linguistic and conceptual continuity, we propose that the national facilities will also be called national research facilities. So it's a minor technical, we hope, improvement, but we look forward to hearing from the committee your views on this. I won't run you through this. It's simply inserting the word research between national and facility throughout. Still on the declaration of national research facilities, this is the third issue we wish to point out to you here. There is no provision in the Act empowering the minister to withdraw the determination of a national research facility or transfer a national research facility. This is what we're currently calling the national facilities, ITEMBA, South African Astronomical Observatory, etc. Section 5 of the Act will now empower the minister to withdraw the determination of a national research facility or to transfer the national research facility from the foundation to any other organ of state. And the text that we have proposed in this regard is a new section, subsection 4 in section 5, which would read, the minister may make regulations relating to the determination of national research facilities, including the requirements and process for their determination. The minister may, after consultation with the foundation and subject to PIA and a few things like that, by notice in the Gazette, withdraw the determination of a national research facility or transfer a national research facility to another public entity or department. And then lastly, the foundation is responsible for A, determining the functions of a national research facility, B, determining the management and funding for national research facilities, C, determining the criteria for access to a national research facility, and D, any other ancillary or procedural matters relating to national research facilities. So the operational management of this is entirely within the remit of the NRF. But the minister plays a role in determining whether there should be a national research facility of a particular kind or not. And the benefit of this is improved strategic focus, planning and coordination, and investment for the provision of research infrastructures to researchers, resulting in more impactful research outputs and outcomes. Turning now to the fourth substantive issue, which I mentioned earlier on, was this issue about the declaration of research institutions. So the minister defining what kinds of institutions may benefit from public research funding through the NRF and which institutions should not. So currently there is no provision for the minister to declare an institution as eligible to receive research funding from the NRF, and this has created problems for the National Research Foundation in the past. So we're proposing that a new section, 5A, be inserted, making a provision for the minister to declare an institution as a research institution and therefore eligible to receive funding from the NRF. And the text that we're proposing, honorable members, is as follows. Under research institutions, the minister may, after consultation with the foundation, declare by notice in the Gazette an institution conducting research as a research institution and eligible to receive grant funding from the foundation. And number two, the minister may, after consultation with the foundation and subject to the provisions of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, by notice in the Gazette, withdraw a declaration of an institution as a research institution. Honorable members and chair, we have the minister has already been exercising this authority, because under the current act, there is a clause in there which allows her to do this already, but it was not sufficiently explicit, we felt, and it was important to make this more explicit. So the minister has already issued regulations, published regulations on two or three occasions when we got requests from certain types of institutions for them to be considered as research institutions qualifying for such funds. So the benefit of this is that public research institutions will be strengthened through gaining more funds towards improving their research. This will assist in consolidating government research funds rather than dispersing them into small, unimpactful work. The fifth, I think, major amendment which I outlined to the committee earlier on was this one about aligning with IPR legislation. And currently the NRF Act makes no reference to the IPR Act, and of course it should, because all the research that the NRF funds in any research institution is subject to the IPR Act, and it's important therefore to pull this relationship between research funded by the NRF and the IPR Act, to pull this through the NRF Act. And so we're proposing the insertion in section 19 of a new subsection, one, the intellectual property rights emanating from any study or research that is funded or undertaken by the foundation is regulated in terms of the intellectual property rights, blah, 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 law, as well as relevant government, as well as relevant acts governing the management of intellectual property or indigenous knowledge. This, of course, refers to IPLA for the time being and the IK bill once the Parliament has finalized this. So this is to a large extent a technical correction of the Act or an updating of the Act. And then the last matter was the clarification of the functions. So currently, the long title of the document of the Act is silent with regard to the role of the minister in providing policy guidelines to the foundation and its responsibilities in respect of science engagement, as well as in providing clarity on inclusion of all research fields, including humanities, social sciences, and indigenous knowledge. So, honourable members, all the things I've previously drawn your attention to, which we've tried to address in the amendments, these things need to be addressed also in the long title for the bill, and we've therefore amended the text of the long title as I've shown in the second last column here. I'll leave the honourable members to read it. I think it's straightforward. It repeats much of the language that I introduced the committee to earlier. I'd like to begin wrapping up by just outlining then to the Honourable Committee the stakeholders and the consultations that we've had on this. So the stakeholders consulted. The bill was published in the Government Gazette for public comment in August last year. In addition to this publication, the DST issued letters to all universities and science councils, including those outside the DST, informing the institutions about the publication of the bill and requesting written comments on the amendment. So we proactively invited them to comment on the bill. On closing the call for comment, submissions from seven organizations were received, namely the Agricultural Research Council, the University of the Witwatersrand, University South Africa, which is of course the consortium of all public universities, the Central University of Technology from Bloemfontein, MINTEC, the Council for Mineral Technology, the Human Sciences Research Council, and the NRF itself. And I'd like to outline now for the committee, briefly, the comments that we received, just briefly highlighting them and outlining the DST's response to those. So firstly, the ARC made mention that in their view, the bill seeks to impact operations of existing science councils and higher education institutions directly or indirectly. This may result in these institutions being stripped of their core infrastructure. Now, quite frankly, we don't know how they can read that in the current bill. The bill only empowers the National Research Foundation to oversee infrastructure that has been declared as a national research facility within the ambit of the of the NRF by the minister, and not any infrastructures under science councils or higher education institutions, namely universities. So we did not see any need to amend the draft for this comment. Turning now to the comments from Wits University, the first point was made here was emphasis on alignment with the national priorities may be a challenge because priorities can change rapidly while research, development, innovation are long-term activities that benefit from long-term visions. Now, quite frankly, honorable members, the implication here is that government and government officials are not capable of long-term thinking in their policy, and we think that's not necessarily the case. So for that reason alone, we were not persuaded that an amendment needed to be made to the document, and we wanted to point out then also that the minister has power over the NRF by virtue of being the executive authority of the National Research Foundation. This is a simple matter of fact. The NRF has political and institutional authority over the National Research Foundation. And this act simply is putting that into words. The NRF may determine its ratio of short-term and long-term research priorities through its internal policies. The NRF is not disempowered from formulating policies specific to its mandate under the Act. And so we did not accept this critique or proposed amendments. And then the second comment was the bill allows the minister to interact directly with the NRF and not through the board. Again, we could not accept this because we did not see anything in the bill that specifically instructed the minister to ignore the board, and it is common practice for the minister to deal with the NRF through the board. But obviously, on a on an occasional basis, the CEO of the NRF and the minister also see each other at meetings. So this was not a helpful input in our view. From the University South Africa Consortium, there were three inputs here which we wanted to highlight. The first is that the minister is being given more powers regarding the national research facilities. Well, yes and no. She is being given more explicitly the power to establish and disestablish a national research facility, but it's in consultation with the National Research Foundation. And in any event, the bill really defines the National Research Facility and codifies the process to be followed for determination as a National Research Facility. The power to determine a National Research Facility vested with the minister all along. The second comment they made is that the minister is empowered to issue policy guidelines. And again, yes, that's the intention of this, is to make clear that the minister does have the authority to issue policy guidelines, and I want to point out again that we're not using the word directives here. The minister is a member of parliament and is the executive authority and already has powers to issue national policy. The bill is simply codifying that point. And then the last major comment from them was that consideration should be given to include inter- and transdisciplinary research instead of just multidisciplinary research. We accepted that point and we amended the draft bill accordingly to make this more explicit. Turning now to the inputs from the National Research Foundation, the first point they made is that the long title should include science engagement and make reference to research performed at the National Research Facilities. We accepted that point and made the amendments. The second point was the inclusion of a provision for incubation of potential new national research facilities prior to their determination. And again, this was a good point, well made, and we amended the draft accordingly to provide for this. And then the last one was the NRF asked that the bill should allow the utilization of provisions of Section 70 of the Income Tax Act for debt recovery. We decided not to amend the bill to make this an explicit responsibility of the NRF, but we encourage the NRF to take this matter up with SARS and see how they could use the Income Tax Act for debt recovery. The last organization that made comments that required some review or reconsideration of the draft was the HSRC. And the HSRC's comment was the minister is being given extensive decision-making powers. And here we again point out that the minister already has powers to issue national policy, and the bill is simply codifying that responsibility and authority. And so we did not make any amendments to the draft in consequence to that comment. And the last comment from the HSRC was that we should ensure alignment of the science engagement definitions and functions with those of the department's science engagement strategy. And that, again, was a point well made, and we did amend the bill accordingly to ensure continuity in the definition of science engagement strategy with the definition of science engagement in the bill itself. My last slide on stakeholder comments, I just wish to point out, although some of the comments we received from the stakeholders I outlined might be interpreted as critical or somewhat critical of the bill, we also received commendations from them. So the tightening of financial control through the provision for the NRF to comply with the Public Finance Management Act, for example, which we've made explicit, I haven't highlighted it to you, this was welcomed. The strengthening of institutional oversight and governance and powers given to the minister to issue national research policy, this was in fact welcomed by many of the respondents. The promotion of inter- and transdisciplinary research and collaboration as explicit functions were welcomed. The clarification of concepts and processes, as I've outlined to the honorable members, were also welcomed. And then the elevation of social sciences and humanities research to be referred to in the same phrase or in the same paragraph as sciences more generically was also welcomed. Then the last slide, honorable members, is in terms of endorsements, we have had extensive consultation with the National Research Foundation and its board and management, and they support the bill in general as it is now. We have presented this and received the support of the ESAID cluster on this. The bill has also undergone the required socio-economic impact analysis of the DPME and has been approved there. And lastly, it has also been approved by the Chief State Law Advisor in respect of its submission to Cabinet and to Parliament. And that brings to an end the presentation on the context for the bill that is before the committee. Thank you very much for your attention, honorable members.
Thank you very much, Dr. Thomas, and for the presentation. And I think the way it's presented so that you focus directly to the areas that need amendment within the bill. Honorable members, do you have questions on the piece? Honorable Korunov?
Jefferson, I think obviously we will, you know, start the process now. Can I just ask, is it now today first time formally tabled to this committee? And is there a process for us to follow if that is the case? And then obviously if I look at the comments, I think we will, as a committee, will probably call for public hearings and to listen those others out with regard to their comments, especially those that were not accepted. But I think that is probably the process we should follow.
Yeah, sure. We will be working on the roadmap towards that. Honorable Tak?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think Nick has partially covered me, because on page 7, slide 30, I wanted to ask what was your expectations of how many submissions you wanted to receive back? And I also would like to know, what do you think, why did other institutions not submit? In this regard, what are you going to do? Does a need arise then to close gaps? And then I think that is where Honorable Kurunov, I think, is covering me, but this is my question. Thank you.
Dr. Thomas.
Thank you, Chairperson. This
thank you, Honorable Members, for your inputs on this, and thank you also, Honorable Chair, for welcoming the way that we've made the presentation. In a certain sense, the two members have asked very closely related questions. I was, to be honest, just speaking for myself, I was a little surprised that we didn't get more, initially, I was a little surprised that we didn't get more inputs on this. But I reflected a little bit more on that then, Honourable Tuck. And I realized that what we are proposing is not, there aren't any really controversial recommendations that we're making. We are largely codifying established practice and making clearer practices or processes that are to some extent in practice or in place already, but haven't been codified in the Act. So it's much more housekeeping than it is anything really substantially new. So I think that's the first thing I realized when I reflected on this. The second thing is that in that context, I then became quite relieved that we didn't get many more inputs, because the honorable members may know that scientists and their institutions can be extremely pedantic, and they can be extremely picky about one word rather than another. And in reflection then, in answer to your question, Honourable Ms. Tuck, I was actually quite relieved that we weren't flooded with a whole lot of individual submissions by Professor X at this institution and Dr. Y at this institution and Professor X at another institution, all complaining about this choice of word rather than that. So this kind of legislation could easily have given rise to a flood of inputs like that because of the constituency and the community that it addresses. So I, in reflection, therefore, going back now, no, I'm not really surprised that we didn't get much more, given the considerations I've just brought to the table. Of course, it's entirely the committee's remit to decide on how you wish to proceed with this. We're at your disposal to facilitate and assist in any way that you wish us to and in any way that we can. My understanding, and this goes to some extent to the question that the Honourable Kurnoff asked, is this is, I think, the first formal presentation in the start of the process that you will now be managing and owning. So that was the purpose of this presentation, was to contextualize this to you. I will ask my colleague Nomonde January just now, perhaps, if she's got anything to add, but having spoken briefly to the committee secretary and also to my colleague Nomonde, who has been working closely with the committee also on the IK bill, you'll recall, my understanding is that there is an opportunity after this presentation for officials in Parliament, those that are assisting the committee on legal aspects, to begin working on some of these things with the department, if you so choose. And we could already start reflecting on some of the subtleties that one might identify, because it's been probably 6 months since we last engaged this document. And when you look at it again now, and you can see actually that word would have been better replaced by this word. So small things like that one recognizes afterwards. And it might be opportune to give representatives of the committee and representatives of the department to just do a fine combing, fine tooth combing of the bill, just to pick up those kinds of little things so that the committee can apply its mind to the more substantive matters. But we're in your hands on this, Honourable Chair and committee members.
Ms. Chandra,
when the bill was published for public comments, University South Africa invited universities to submit their comments through their office. So the comments that you see that are submitted by USAF are actually a consolidation of what was submitted by universities, though other universities also submitted individually.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we will deal with the process early next year, as we did with the IKS bill when we started in January. So we'll have to advertise and invite comments. We'll then also have to work out the public engagement process. We will engage with the Parliament's legal services and also the state law advisor. And then definitely Martin will be there throughout as usual. But as with the past bill, the IKS bill, where the directorate was here, every time we're dealing with that bill, they were with us. They worked with us. So we'd also request the same participation and commitment from yourselves so that at the end we own up to everything. And also if there are technical issues, you are there to clarify. And Martin will also give us views from the minister and stuff like that. So, but we are looking forward to engaging the bill. At least it's an amendment bill, so we're not starting from scratch like the previous one. Yeah, and as I said, also our content advisor and the secretary to the committee will bring together the same team that we had with the previous bill to work out and see also the legality, the language that is now used, and everything in relation to this bill. Welcome, Professor Kubisa.
Thanks, Chair. Let me apologize. I had three other meetings, Chief Whips, Higher Education, and the Political Party Funding. So,
you see, it's because you're a professor. You have to...
Because we're a few.
Thank you very much. Welcome. I don't think that there's anything else that we need to, but we welcome this amendment bill, and we're looking forward to engaging with it. And the public process is one that is also very exciting and interesting. And like the other bill, at the end of it, you find our members also wanting to continue with the academic qualification in that field. So we hope also this bill will also have that interest that members will want to continue with their academic, as some of us have committed with the IKS bill. So, but thank you very much to you, Dr. Thomas, Martin, the department, legal people and so forth, and so that brings us to the end of this presentation. Honourable members, this is also our last meeting, so there's no meeting next week, but we will keep you informed of the roadmap on what, and then you can make your inputs there and see how we go about. But one would like to take this opportunity to thank you for the unwavering support that and your commitment to all the work of the committee throughout the year, and wishing you a deserved break and time with your families that throughout the year. Dr. Lotrit has been extremely busy. But fortunately, we're able to see her on TV nowadays more often. thank you very much, Honorable Members. So this brings us to the end of the meeting. Honorable Lotrit, Dr. Lotrit, you want to say something?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, but I think I would also, from our side, say thank you to you. This is arguably the best committee to serve on. I think in terms of our interaction and the support we get. So it's always exciting and always nice to come. And I think especially under your chairmanship, chairpersonship, And yes, also the same to you, that you have a good time to rest after the exams, and we hope you get the results that you are hoping for.
Thank you very much, Chair. I, on behalf of the department, since this is the last meeting, and so you won't be formally meeting with the DG again or the minister, so therefore at the moment I think I'm the ranking official. I would also then on behalf of the department like to thank the committee for the wonderful support that you've been giving us, not just in the last year, but throughout our engagement with you. This has been a particularly intense year around the IK Bill, for example, where we greatly appreciate the support and the effort made by the committee. And I very much look forward to engaging you on this bill next year. We will certainly commit the required officials' time to support the committee. I personally will take a much more direct role in this wherever I can, because on this one I feel I can add some value. On the IK one, really, my best staff were working with you. I could not have outthought them on this one. So I look forward to meeting personally more with the committee around this next year. And on behalf of the department, wish you all the great recess, successful conferences, events, functions, whatever you might be going to individually over the next few months, and a wonderful Christmas and New Year. And we hope that you come back relaxed from some time with your family and loved ones in the New Year. All the best wishes.
Enough.
Just a housekeeping question. There was an invitation on the conference of NAACI. I just want to know whether we are sending somebody there and whether there is a need to send somebody. I think on the 6th of December.
Okay, I think in the last week's meeting we agreed that we were going to submit an application for that. We got the quotes back, and so we're in the process of, if the chairperson is only back today, so she will sign off on those things and we'll be submitting it anyway. I normally just apply for everybody, and then when we do our checking and people indicate whether they, but as per our agreement in the last meeting, I just put a application for everybody.
Hi, Martin.
Sorry, Chair, I'm delaying the members now, but just by way of a commercial, straight after that Global Forum of Science Advisory Councils is the Science Forum South Africa, which, so on the 5th, 6th, and then the 7th and 8th is the Science Forum, which is a magnificent event. So if members are going up for the 5th and 6th, if they can afford an extra day or two, it would be really very interesting. Sorry?
Can you send us the program?
I think it may already be with Shanaz.
Sorry, man. I do have all that information, and I did put the application for the whole week. But I haven't had a chance to speak to our chairperson since he's back, so I couldn't communicate to the members before speaking to her. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you once again, Honourable Members. There, we will make sure that you get informed of all these activities, and also to indicate your availability there. And lastly, I would also like to thank you for the support that you've also given me. On Friday, I'm writing my very last module, and I hope to be done with this degree. But thank you for your support. You've always encouraged me, and you always supported me. Yeah. You always.
This is your last module for your LLB.
Yes.
Well, good luck.
Thank you very much, Prof. Thank you. Yes. Yeah, with that, the meeting is adjourned, and Merry Christmas to all of you, and all of the best for the coming year. Thanks. Shanaz and Renee and Tandukolo for your commitment and helping the and your support to the committee. Thank you very much.